Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Giles Milton presenting Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, the true story of a top-secret organization founded in London whose purpose was to plot the destruction of Hitler's war machine through spectacular acts of sabotage. This gripping narrative of adventure and derring-do is also perhaps the last great untold story of the Second World War. Tuesday, March 6th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.
Hello once again from the Baltimore Sun. This is Roughly Speaking, and I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist. Today is Thursday, March 1st, 2018, and on the show, Ben Jealous, former president and CEO of the NAACP, is seeking the Democratic nomination for governor of Maryland. He's been on the show before. This time, he stops by to talk about policing in Baltimore. Yesterday, Ben Jealous released a comprehensive plan to help reform the Baltimore City Police Department, and he proposed some statewide reforms to address police misconduct everywhere. Before we get to our conversation with Ben Jealous, here's Paula Gallagher, Baltimore County librarian and Roughly Speaking critic, with this week's book recommendation.
Dan, today's book is a novel called The Driest Season by Megan Kenney. And this is a coming-of-age story that takes place over a single impactful summer in 1943 in a small Wisconsin town. 15-year-old Seal finds her father's body hanging from a beam in the family barn in the very first sentence of this novel, which grabs you and doesn't let go. First-time novelist Kenney adopted a prize-winning short story into this slim novel of just 189 pages. The story unfolds quietly and powerfully in poetic sentences of economy, short and impactful. It's a deep dive into small-town relationships and familial love and the meaning of a community. Seal's memories of her father, what she knew of the man and what she clearly didn't, preserving his memory and making choices to preserve their family. It's a struggle to make sense and to figure out what comes next. And then, of course, the background of the distant war that begins to hit close to home. The book is beautifully written with characters that stay with you. And again, these themes of family love, altered truths, loyalty, responsibility, and the inner lives of adults. This is a beautiful novel, and I only wish I had more time to spend with Seal. Sometimes I read a novel and I think, wow, this is just going too long. It needs to be edited. This is a book that I would have liked to have seen more of, and I'd like to see this character 10 years in the future. Author Megan Kenney has a bit of a Baltimore tie, and looking into her, I found out that she wrote as a part of a fellowship at Gilman School, where she wrote and taught back in the 2008-2009 school year. Again, this is The Driest Season by Megan Kenney.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian with the Baltimore County System. You can find her at the Pikesville branch and here on the Roughly Speaking podcast. Now to our conversation with Ben Jealous about policing in Baltimore. He is among candidates for the Democratic nomination for governor of Maryland in the June primary. Yesterday, Ben Jealous released a comprehensive plan to help reform the Baltimore City Police Department, and he proposed some statewide reforms to address police misconduct everywhere. What do you say to people who think Baltimore City's problems are Baltimore's problems? That's for the mayor and the police commissioner and the city council to figure out. What's the governor doing in this anyway?
So goes Baltimore, so goes Maryland. It's always been that way. We have a governor who has become content to make Baltimore his whipping boy in the worst type of dog whistle politics tradition that goes back to men like George Wallace.
What do you mean by that?
He uses Baltimore as an epithet. Now, my family's been rooted in the city since 1941. For us, Baltimore is synonymous with hustle and aspiration. But for this governor, he uses it to encourage voters in the suburbs and the exurbs, stoke their fears, and encourage them to turn out for him, somebody who has contempt for the city and basically is here, if you will, to like sort of protect them against the city, when really, when we build up this city, it's an engine for the entire state.
Okay, well, I'm going to challenge you on some of these things.
Sure.
As someone listening to this might. They say, no, Larry Hogan saved the city, first of all, from the riots in 2015.
Larry Hogan's first mistake was he should have just put on his jeans and come down to the city and walk around and talk to the citizens. The reality is that you aren't governor of some of the people. You are governor of all the people. And when you do that, what you find out is that people in neighborhoods like Upton, the neighborhood that my mom spent more than half her childhood in, are just regular folks. And when they feel like the trust has been abused by the officers who have sworn to protect and respect them, you know, they respond the way Americans have responded since the days of the Boston Massacre. I mean, it's just real basic complaints. Here's the funny thing. People will look at an impoverished neighborhood with a problem of violence, and they'll call it a high crime area. You know what that also means? It's a high victim area. People there need the police more than anywhere else, and they want them to serve them. And that's what this plan is about. It's about making us safer, and at the core of it's about restoring trust. And one of the things I say here that this governor should have done that I will do as governor is do what Governor Rockefeller did back in the day and appoint a special prosecutor to deal with that minority of officers who create problems for everybody else, make us all less safe, make other officers less safe. Those bad officers, the ones who are too violent, the ones that are corrupt, deal with them in an impartial way that holds them accountable to the scales of justice as we all are held.
Well, that's one of the points in this proposal you rolled out on Wednesday. Why do you need a special prosecutor?
You need a special prosecutor because, as we saw with the Gun Trace Task Force, right now we have police policing themselves. One of the things in that trial that I took note of, I think many people may have missed because it wasn't really in the headlines, was that they appeared to have a mole inside of internal affairs. Several of the points in this proposal are about greater civilian oversight. And the ultimate expression of that is having a special prosecutor.
That would be someone aside from the state's attorney's office.
That's
of course,
right.
Lots of assistant state's attorneys have relationships with police officers.
State's attorney's offices are notoriously political offices. We have the FOP. A word had spread throughout the city 6-8 months ago that they were looking to invest in electing a new state's attorney. Well, when your union, it writes big checks for who the state's attorney is, how can we expect them to actually police your union?
Civilians on this police misconduct review board, on hearing boards, this has been talked about now for the last 2 or 3 years, well, since Freddie Gray. You're saying that this board should not only have civilians on it, there should be a majority of civilians on the board.
We are a democracy, and what is great about a democracy, what allows us to function at our best, is when we are all accountable to each other. The notion that civilians don't know enough, people like myself, say, who teaches criminal justice policy at Princeton University, don't know enough because we don't carry a badge ourselves, is folly. The reality is that the civilians are the consumers of all public services, including law enforcement services, and they should ultimately be able to hold law enforcement accountable to the values, to the laws, to the mores of their community.
Ben, I want to pull you off to the side of the road again here one more time to go
Sure.
over this idea that the governor should be involved in Baltimore's affairs as when it comes
since
to the
Civil War, BPD has been a dual jurisdiction agency, as we know.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
But again, they think this is the business of the mayor, city council, and the police commissioner. Are you saying the city's having a crisis now? The city's been in a crisis with violent crime for 3 years,
yes.
And now we've had all kinds of problems internally with the police department. So is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is, look, historically, governors in Maryland have understood that going back to the Civil War, Baltimore Police Department, there are two jurisdictions that have responsibility for it. There's the city and there's the state. That's why we had a joint criminal justice task force that the governor has a seat on and is supposed to show up to the meetings. In this period when things were falling apart, our governor never showed up to the meetings. When he finally went to a meeting several months ago, he went there to shut down the commission. What I'm saying is that what has worked historically, what worked prior to 3 years ago, note that coincides with his term in office, was governors being involved in making sure that the city was safe. This city is a major economic engine in our state. It is a hub of entertainment for the region. And again, since the Civil War, the governor has had special responsibility for making sure that it functions effectively. And we need to get back to that tradition. And a lot of this is really about making sure that the city has the support that it needs, making sure that there's greater support for police training, for police recruiting, for incentivizing officers from our city, for building apprenticeship programs to lead young people into the police force. I mean, what inspired me to become a criminologist, so my graduate work is in, and that's what part of what I teach at Princeton, was my grandfather, who was a probation officer here for 3 decades, and his peers.
A probation officer?
Yeah. My grandfather was chief of juvenile probation for the western part of the city. He was at the city court for 3 decades. His name was Jerome Todd. And he was my hero when I was a kid. I remember one day, summers, you know, in Baltimore, violence ticking up every summer. And I looked at my granddad, and he's putting his badge in his pocket to walk out the door to work. And I said, aren't you ever scared? Like, some of these young people are pretty violent. And he said, of course I am. And that's why I tell all of them, this is my address. I get home at 6 p.m. sharp every night. If you've just had the worst day of your life, which means that they could have killed somebody, you just come sit on my steps. And when I get home, we'll sit down and we'll figure it out together. My grandfather's ethos was courage today, save lives tomorrow. Love today makes us stronger tomorrow. And he loved all of those young men, not just because he was paid to serve the community, because he was of the community. He'd raise his daughter, my mom, half her childhood in McCullough Homes housing projects. The other half her childhood split between Pulaski Street and Longwood, North Longwood. And had eventually kind of moved the Jefferson's route, if you will, of West Baltimore, ended up in Ashburton. But he loved the city, and he was intimately connected to families across the West Side. There's still probation officers down there that my grandfather trained. I bumped into one of them at a church the other day. And you serve with more courage and more commitment when you're serving a place where your heart is embedded, that you can never disconnect from. There's no moving to Pennsylvania. There's only here. And we need more officers like that. And that's why, you know, we even put in here restoring funds for the Police Athletic League training centers. Again, because as you and I both know, you know, that's how young people kind of first, you know, who aren't related to officers as I was, first find an officer who's their hero and decide to be a hero themselves.
It sounds like in your plan you want to provide the city with some more money so it can do some things proactively, more training of officers to improve use of force standards and training, that's in here, improve officer recruitment, getting officers to walk the beat, so more foot patrols.
It's critical. It's critical.
Foot patrols.
So
this isn't just like we're encouraging this. You're saying as governor you would put some more money into it.
Yeah. Right? As a governor, I will be actively involved in lifting up Baltimore, period. This governor has been actively involved in putting down Baltimore and short-circuiting Baltimore and redlining the red line and using our city as an epithet. I will do just the opposite. You know, my grandma was a social worker here in the city. She helped train a young Barbara Mikulski. My grandma's 101. What my grandmother would say is, nothing good happens here unless the governor wants it to. Our governor has so much control over the budget. The state can only, you know, the state legislators can only subtract from that budget. And I'll never forget that. She also told me that you can't half solve a problem, son. If you half solve a problem, you still got a problem, and it might get worse. And so my campaign, whether it's about police reform or it's about Medicare for all, is about presenting whole solutions that move our state forward. And again, at the center of moving our state forward is moving our city forward. One thing that we know, unfortunately, by studying how the war on drugs failed, is that if you have the wrong financial incentives for police forces, you get the wrong outcomes. So, you know, one of the things that killed the war on drugs was they said, look, you'll get more money from the federal government to have more officers in your department if you can prove that there is a problem with drug addiction and you're making progress towards it. They defined each by arresting low-level drug offenders. So we began to fill up prisons with low-level drug offenders. What I'm saying is we got to change the incentives, and we do it from the state level. we have to shift from this failed so-called broken windows theory, which says we go after all these little small things trying to prevent big things, recognize that doing that failed, and one of the ways we saw that was police officers began solving fewer murders, solving fewer rapes, even opening fewer rape kits. And we've got to put the incentives back where they were. You start with the most serious crimes. And that means focusing on bringing down homicides. When jurisdictions have gotten police officers out of their cars, two things happen. Back walking the beat, two things happen. One, trust goes up. They know those officers. Those officers know them. And two, intelligence flows more freely. And three, as a result, more homicides get solved. More killers get off the streets. The neighborhood gets safer. When I was down in Sanford, Florida, in response to the Trayvon Martin killing, and we just needed to restore trust, that was the number one thing that the new chief that we helped bring in did, was get his officers out of their cars. And it's something that we need. It's something that folks are asking for. We've got to integrate police back into the community, if you will, you know, as officer friendly, as that officer that you know, and you don't just know who he is, but you know when he's going to come around that block each day. And if there's something that you need to tell him, you can just walk past him and just say a few words, and no one will even know that you spoke to him. If that officer's in a car, you have to walk out in the middle of the street, flag him down, and you could have a target on your back before you get back to the sidewalk. And that's how homicides don't get solved. And if somebody's had two family members shot in Maryland in the last 10 years, including one who had agreed to testify against drug dealers, we've got to restore trust, we've got to protect witnesses better, and we've got to get more killers off the street. Walking the beat will help with all those things.
There's something you said a moment before about two family members being shot.
Yeah.
That's the first I've heard you mention that.
Yeah, so it's not something I talk about often. One of them, you know, neither in the city, by the way. Both of them, family members who start out in the city and move other places trying to get away from violence. And so it also speaks to sort of the fallacy that if you escape Baltimore, you know, you're safe. No, we are all connected.
Can you talk about who they were?
Sure,
who are they?
Sure. So one of them was a young cousin, 18 years old, just graduated from Columbia High School, and was at a gas station and ran into the wrong angry young man who felt insulted by the way that my cousin responded to him. Apparently that young man went back, got a gun, hunted my cousin down and shot him dead. The other one was an older cousin. He had gone to Douglas High, he had gone to Morgan State, he had grown up on the west side. His dad used to, at the time of the Great Migration, kind of owned the first black owned furniture store in the city. He was a lifelong entrepreneur, and he was nearing his retirement. And there was an employee at his company, he owned a company that did chemical compounding, who had stolen some chemicals to help meth dealers. And the police came, and they said, how'd they get these from your company? And he looked back and saw that the inventory had been stolen. And he agreed to testify. And the dealers knocked on his door, and he opened his door, and they shot him in the stomach.
He survived?
He survived, and then he died. He was a diabetic, so it started a cascade of complications, and he died of the complications a couple years later.
One last thing. There's so much talk about guns and gun violence, specifically mass killings with assault rifles. So where are you on all of that? Maryland already has a ban on the sale of assault rifles.
So. Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump saying that we should have teachers carry guns is as insane as him saying that he would have run into that school even if he didn't have a gun. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure he can run. But secondly, like, let's be really clear, you know, secondly, he just doesn't strike me as like Rambo, no matter what he is in his head, you know, or even MacGyver. So let's be real. You know, I grew up shooting guns. I had a neighbor who was a police officer. He trained me to shoot guns from a very young age. And they're extremely powerful and they're extremely deadly. And if you don't know what you're doing or you're scared, you will shoot somebody and not hit the person you're trying to shoot. So in a classroom of 30 or 35 kids, a teacher having a gun is a recipe for disaster, one. Two, we've got to be serious about getting weapons of war out of the hands of young people, not making them available. I don't think we should be selling AR-15s in our state. Anybody who tells you that they need an AR-15 to hunt a deer doesn't know how to hunt deer. We just had a young person in Montgomery County. He came to school with a loaded gun that went back to his house. He had an AR-15. He had multiple hand grenades. He had a detonator for landmines. One of the things that we need is a multi-state task force to focus on shutting down the illegal gun trade into our state. Drug gangs are known to go as far as Maine to get to a state with lax gun laws. They reportedly trade. You know, it's easier for us to get drugs here. We have a big port, so they'll bring drugs up there. They'll trade them for guns. They'll bring guns back here. That's something that the state police should be more focused on. And when I'm governor, they will be.
Ben Jealous, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Ben Jealous is the former national president and CEO of the NAACP. He is among candidates for the Democratic nomination for governor of Maryland in the June primary. That's our show for now. In the Roughly Speaking archives, you can find previous episodes of the show featuring candidates for governor of Maryland. Governor Larry Hogan, the incumbent, is invited to appear at any time. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again on Friday.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.